Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
1 hour, about 24 questions. That's the scorecard from the president's press conference this morning. A lot of Iran, some health care, and whether the economy is getting better. Not yet, by the way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday today, the 23rd of June. Good to have you with us. President Obama had three things he wanted to talk about at his press conference this morning: Iran, energy policy, and health care. He didn't do so bad. He went 2 for 3. The White House press corps didn't really bite on the energy thing. Iran and what Mr. Obama has had to say so far about their election last week took up a good chunk of time, but there were some questions about his health care plan in there, how much any overhaul might cost.
All right, so there's been a lot of talk about, well, a $1 trillion price tag. What I've said is, if we're going to spend that much money, then it's going to be largely funded through reallocating dollars that are already in the healthcare system but aren't being spent well.
And what the much talked about public insurance option might mean to private companies in the healthcare market.
If private insurers say that the marketplace provides the best quality healthcare, if they tell us that they're offering a good deal, then why is it that the government, which they say can't run anything, suddenly is going to drive them out of business? That's not logical.
And finally, a word about Ben Bernanke. It came pretty early in the press conference. The president was asked how the Fed chairman's been doing of late and whether he's going to reappoint Mr. Bernanke when his term is up at the end of January. Nice try, the president said, but no dice.
I'm not going to make news about Ben Bernanke, although I think he has done a fine job. Under very difficult circumstances.
So I'd say that's what? Maybe on the reappointment question, right? On the larger economy, there were some small signs of progress today. They are still down year over year, but used home sales for May were up nearly 2.5% from April, when they were in turn up from March. But prices continue to take a beating. We asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith to figure out why.
The median home price is down about 17% from last year. The reason? Foreclosures, of course. Buyers are bargain hunting, and owners of more expensive houses aren't selling unless they have to. But there's another problem, says economist Lawrence Yoon with the National Association of Realtors. He says appraisals are coming in low.
The buyer and the seller agree to a price, yet when an appraisal is coming in, it is coming in much lower than the agreed price.
If the appraiser values the home at less than what the buyer agreed to pay, the buyer, not the mortgage lender, has to make up the difference.
I heard about one just last week.
Colorado realtor Marianne Snigg says this is causing deals to fall through.
The buyer will need to come out of pocket for the difference, and a lot of times the buyer can't.
Or won't. Columbia University housing economist Chris Mayer says appraisals are coming in low because home values are still falling.
I think that's a bit like blaming the messenger for the bad news. Prices are falling in housing and, you know, down payments are unfortunately going to be high and it's going to be very hard to complete transactions. So I think yelling at appraisers is misplaced blame.
Mayer says foreclosures are the real culprit in driving down prices, and more of those are on the way. As long as bargain basement homes are coming onto the market, all buyers will be looking for deals. And as long as that continues, Mayer says, prices have nowhere to go but down. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
It's been 100 and some odd years now since the Wright brothers made their first flight on the beach at Kitty Hawk in North Carolina, but it seems we are still learning how to fly. This morning, Boeing announced another setback for its 787 Dreamliner. That makes 5 times that the company's had to put off the first test flight of its new fuel-efficient flying machine. Boeing could pay a heavy price in cost overruns and delivery penalties to its customers. But our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports there's really not much threat the world's airlines are going to take their business elsewhere.
I am really proud to premiere the Boeing 787 Dreamliner.
So
Since the first 787 was rolled out 2 years ago, Boeing executives have had more luck building excitement than Dreamliners. The cutting-edge plane is already 2 years behind schedule, and today Chief Executive Scott Carson delivered more bad news during a conference call. The Dreamliner's carbon composite wing attachments need reinforcing before the first test flight can get off the ground.
The tests that we've been running are intended to ensure that any issues are uncovered and solutions are found earlier rather than later.
But it's disturbingly late to be turning up trouble now, as aviation analyst Richard Abulafia of the Teal Group sees it. With 850 planes on order, some airlines had been expecting delivery later this year. Now Boeing can only say it'll be several weeks before it can set a new target date.
The question is, what happens next? Is this a harbinger of further problems that haven't been fully uncovered? Is this an aircraft that simply needs additional work moving forward?
At Oak Brook Investments, Peter Jankowskis isn't as concerned. He argues that Boeing is way ahead of its European rival Airbus, and delays are inevitable with cutting-edge technology. He also points out customers aren't likely to take their business elsewhere.
Certainly many airlines right now are probably hoping to have a delay in their order cycle so they can build up some more revenue before they take delivery of the planes.
If Boeing needs to have a delay, he says, now might just be a good time. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
There was another aviation delay today. The company that ran the ClearPass program went out of business overnight. Clear's 250,000-plus frequent flyers paid for a faster trip through security at airports from Orlando to San Francisco. Parent company Verified Identity Pass blamed its demise on not being able to renegotiate its debt. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there were some other problems, too.
Kevin O'Connor is a frequent flyer who was a satisfied customer of Clear.
You show up, you give them a fingerprint, you show them your Clear pass, and then you go to the line. You still had to do the shoes off and all that sort of thing. But, I mean, there was virtually no waiting at all. It was just great.
But that wasn't enough for some Clear customers who felt they'd been promised an even smoother experience, says Binay Wilson, who reports on the airline business for Aviation Week.
They were supposed to have these scanners that would have allowed you to keep your shoes on, your coat on, and your laptops in the bag. But the Transportation Security Administration wasn't happy with the clear rates, no pun intended, on those scanners. And I think people felt at that point, well, this is kind of not what I signed up for.
Also, Clear was unable to move into some big airports like Chicago's O'Hare or Miami International. One reason many major airlines with their own bypass lines for premier customers lobbied against Clear. Paul Rudin at the American Society of Travel Agents says most travelers didn't think the service was worth $200 a year.
It was a nice, nifty idea, but, you know, it faced too many obstacles. It was too slow evolving to reach the critical mass that you have to have.
Clear's founder is entrepreneur Stephen Brill. He left the company earlier this year, but says he's surprised Clear couldn't settle with its creditors. There are still two small companies that offer speedier screenings, but they're only at a handful of airports, like Reno and Jacksonville. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders took a step back from yesterday's declines and did nothing much at all, really. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The auto industry got another injection of government cash today, but hold on a second before you sit down to write your congressman, because the cast of characters is different this time around. The Department of Energy is giving Ford almost $6 billion and another $2 billion to Nissan and Tesla so they can build more fuel-efficient cars. Justin Hyde is a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. He's based in Washington, D.C. Justin, good to have you with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kai.
Give us the background on this investment. It didn't just come out of the blue, did it?
No, this has been in the works for a couple of years now. Back in 2007, the auto industry agreed to a new set of fuel economy standards with a target of 35 miles per gallon by 2020 on average. As part of that agreement, Congress and the Bush administration set aside $25 billion in loans that would help the auto industry retool its plants and do the engineering to build those vehicles in the United States. Now, Congress only got around to paying for those loans last year. And as the economy worsened, there was a great hue and cry from the industry and its supporters to speed up the outlay of these loans. So this first tranche of loans for Ford, Nissan, and Tesla came about a lot faster than what the industry had originally thought might be necessary.
Faster, I assume, to help a struggling economy.
Right, to help the struggling economy, create jobs or save jobs, as the formulation goes with some of the stimulus money. The Obama administration said today that just the loan to Ford could help save some 35,000 jobs at more than 11 Ford plants spread across five states. You know, the industry is facing its worst sales years now in a couple of decades, and these improvements are going to be expensive. Since the agreement with the Bush administration, the industry has come back into a new agreement with the Obama administration. That 35-mile-per-gallon target is now set for 2016. The automakers have torn up their plans, gone back to the drawing board, planning a lot more fuel-efficient vehicles, a lot more electric and alternative vehicles, and those will cost even more money to develop.
So we've got Ford, Tesla, and Nissan from Japan. As a U.S. taxpayer and thus a shareholder of another couple of car companies in this economy, say General Motors and Chrysler, couldn't help but notice they're not on the list.
Well, General Motors and Chrysler didn't qualify for the loans. One of the original standards when the loan program was created was that the automaker or the parts company that received this money had to be financially viable. And it's hard to be financially viable when you're bankrupt, as General Motors is right now and as Chrysler was until recently. The new Chrysler and new GM that are expected to be created out of bankruptcy are counting on some of this loan money to come to them in the future, roughly about $6 billion apiece, to help them fund their development of more fuel-efficient models, things like the Chevrolet Volt, just as Ford is doing with the money right now.
Let me ask you about Tesla, this small startup, all-electric vehicle out here in Southern California. Is there an element of picking winners here? I mean, this company gets $500 million from the government.
It's an interesting allotment. It does signal some sort of vote of confidence in Tesla by the government that the company is going to be around long enough to return this $465 million. Now, that said, Tesla already had backing from Daimler AG. It's doing a deal to help develop smart electric vehicles. It's producing electric roadsters right now. The money that it'll be getting from the government will go towards building this Model S electric sedan and creating a plant that it would use to provide electric motors and technology to other automakers. The point of the program wasn't necessarily so much to pick winners and losers, but to speed the development of vehicles from whoever was best positioned. In this case, right now, it's Ford, Nissan, and Tesla. There are some 100 companies that have applied for this money, and more awards should be coming soon.
Justin Hyde in Washington for the Detroit Free Press. Justin, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We have our first hurricane of the 2009 season. Hurricane Andres is expected to reach Mexico's west coast later today. In prime U.S. hurricane territory, that is mostly the state of Florida, there are still fresh memories of the devastating storms they have had there the past several years. Strangely, though, insurance rates haven't kept pace with public worries. Florida froze insurance premiums 2 years ago. That let builders keep building in the face of a saturated real estate market. And it could mean everybody gets soaked if the weather gets really bad. From Miami, Marketplace's Dan Grench reports.
Florida keeps insurance rates low by doing something no other state has tried. It subsidizes the cost of reinsurance. Reinsurance is basically insurance for insurance companies. An insurer agrees to cover, say, the first $10 billion in damage after a storm. Reinsurance kicks in to cover the rest. Private firms charge around 25 cents for each dollar of reinsurance protection. The state-run Hurricane Catastrophe Fund, or CAT Fund, charges 2 cents for each dollar of protection, so homeowners pay lower premiums. There's one big problem. The CAT Fund can't cover its commitments.
Our current strategy in Florida is prayer.
That's Jim Massey with the Reinsurance Association of America.
We're praying that we don't have a hurricane. And prayer is good, but I don't know that we can count on it to pay insurance claims.
The Florida CAT Fund relies on its ability to borrow money to pay claims. But last fall, the credits market seized. The CAT Fund was suddenly short $17 billion. Massey says Florida's experiment in state-subsidized reinsurance could end in disaster.
The CAT Fund violates one of the cardinal principles of insurance, which is spreading the risk. The CAT Fund concentrates the risk within the state of Florida. Private reinsurers sell that risk around the world. Bermuda, Japan, London.
Florida created its CAT Fund after Hurricane Andrew in 1992. The fund has since grown to sell $27 billion in storm protection, making it the state's dominant reinsurer. By keeping premiums low, the CAT fund made property in Florida more affordable. That helped pave the way for Florida's building boom. Robert Hartwig is president of the Insurance Information Institute. He says cut-rate insurance allowed Florida developers to overbuild and Florida homeowners to overbuy.
There's no question that the state's policy of providing subsidized insurance has led and contributed to the state's real estate disaster.
Hartwig says the only way for the CAT fund to have enough money to cover its obligations would be for it to hike the premiums it charges. That would reflect the true cost of reinsurance. Ron Klein is a Democratic congressman from South Florida. He says Florida needs to rely more heavily on private reinsurance, but the government must take a role in keeping those companies in check.
Unfortunately, there's sort of a failure of the market. It's a handful of companies that are charging whatever they can charge. A lot of people would say, well, that's whatever the market will bear, but people can't afford it. You're pricing them out of their home. That's not a good thing.
Klein wants to create a national pool for catastrophic risk that could sell bonds to the private market. Others suggest the federal government should float mega catastrophe bonds after a major disaster, but those solutions are far off. Despite new state legislation, the Florida CAT Fund is still short billions of dollars this hurricane season. In the event of a big one, the state may not have the money to pay claims. In Miami, I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Coming up, putting the plastic on hold.
I tried to go out the other day without any credit cards at all because I think that when I reach that, I'll be a success.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials bounced up and down all day long today before posting a loss of 16 points, about 0.2%, closed at 8,322. The NASDAQ swung back and forth as well, but ended down just 1.7%, 1764 the number. The S&P 500 finished the day on a positive note, rising 2 points, about 0.2%, 895 there. Bargain hunters paid particular attention to financials as they picked through the wreckage of yesterday's big sell-off. J.P. Morgan Chase rebounded about 2.2%. Bank of America saw a bump of about 2.4%. ConocoPhillips also tapped into investor enthusiasm. Shares rose just over 2% there. Ford shares drove up 2.8% today on that news we told you about that it's in line for a government loan worth billions of dollars. Investors felt particularly friendly today after getting word that MySpace, the social networking site, will shed 300 jobs. Shares of parent company News Corp rose 0.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing firsthand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
Marketplace Statebook. Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases two reports, durable goods orders and sales of new homes, both for the month of May. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee convenes a roundtable discussion, Iran at a crossroads. And Peter Weller of RoboCop fame, one of many credits, turns 62. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. As we mentioned to start with today, President Obama spent some time at his press conference this morning talking about health care, why he thinks some kind of public insurance plan has to be part of any overhaul, and how he's determined not to add substantially to the budget deficit to get reform done. Commentator Jonathan Weiner says there's really only one way to trim the fat.
For decades, health care inflation has outstripped economic growth by 3 to 1. The main reason for these skyrocketing costs? Medical technology, a $100,000 biotech drug for cancer, a $600 MRI for tennis elbow, or a $3 purple pill for whatever. It all adds up. Today, deciding what's medically necessary is a rather haphazard business controlled by insurance companies. They try to make the right decisions, but the process is very flawed and often centers on the conflict between payer or provider profits rather than on patient welfare. So who should decide what care is or isn't covered? What we need is a healthcare Fed, a panel of independent experts, consumers, and ethicists who would make these tough decisions based on scientific evidence about what works and what doesn't. Technologies that are real advances would go on the A-list and be covered in full. Me Too drugs or devices with modest benefit for patients would only get partial coverage. And forget about treatments with unsubstantiated efficacy. You'd be shocked by how little the medical community knows about which interventions really work. A healthcare Fed would set national priorities for medical effectiveness research. You may balk at more government oversight, but would you rather have your employer or the medical corporations decide? Or maybe we should just leave your family doc alone to prescribe as she or he sees fit. But it's utterly impossible for them to handle all of this information on their own. How do we know a healthcare Fed can work? Because every other industrialized nation in the world has something just like it. The Brits have one, as do the Canadians and Australians. That's why their costs are lower and patient outcomes better. It's great that they're exploring private and public options on Capitol Hill, and it's even better yet that the medical industry has pledged to play nice. But reform of any kind will fail unless we find a rational and ethical way to eliminate the endemic of ineffective care.
Jonathan Weiner is a professor of health policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health in Baltimore, Maryland. Your thoughts are always welcome. Online works best. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. This being a recession and all, conventional wisdom says we ought to be living within our means, not buying things we can't afford, and definitely not buying them on credit. In fact, what do you suppose would happen if consumers got rid of their credit cards, just cut them up and switched to cash only? Marketplace's Sean Cole explored a world without credit cards, hypothetically anyway.
Before we get into what would happen if a lot of us stopped using credit cards, we should probably ask whether that's likely.
Because I don't really think it is.
James Chesson is chief economist for the American Bankers Association, and of course a big champion of credit cards. He says we have to distinguish between people who just dip their toes in the river of credit every month and those who are drowning in it.
56% of cardholders don't ever revolve any balance, so there's absolutely no reason why they would stop using it. They're using it for a convenience.
Actually, there is a reason. Some of these cardholders are getting fed up with the banks that issue their cards. People like Mary Grace Dembeck.
These were the two letters that I got sent. Now, the day I.
Mary's a painter and a children's book author and a grandmother in Connecticut. The letters she showed me were both from credit card companies. One of them was shutting down and closing her account. She felt kind of bad for them. The other said it was raising her annual percentage rate out of the blue.
So, what did you think of that?
Oh, I was incensed. You know, because I'm on automatic pay, so I've never missed a payment.
And she's been trying to get off the plastic anyway. She's got four or five cards, and lately she's looked at them as little enemies, tempting her to overshop.
I tried to go out the other day without any credit cards at all, because I think that when I reach that, I'll be a success.
So you are literally trying to leave home without it.
I am.
Which brings us back to our original question. What if a lot of Americans, out of anger or necessity, or just because they feel like it, decide to switch to cash?
Well, it's incredibly disruptive to the entire national economy.
This is Robert Manning, the guy who wrote Credit Card Nation.
I mean, the more cash that flows through the system, the more personal attention to money flows, the less fees that the banking system will get, the higher the cost.
He talked like this for 2 minutes straight, and it was interesting. He managed to wind his way from the economic impact to this vision of a total cultural shift.
Forcing people to save and plan, and by the time they actually plan and save to purchase an item, they may decide that they really don't need it. I mean, it will be a complete transformation of American society.
And you know how often those happen. Manning says a lot of people still expect everything to go back to normal. So why change their habits? Of course, it's not like America was always a credit card nation. It used to be cash was the only option, and some people are still living that way. When I read
place I'm going, I will sure.
People like the legendary country singer Wynonna Judd. For a long time, she was a real spendaholic. Says she lost her fortune at one point, and then she cut up her credit cards.
When I go into Target or any of these stores, I pull out my little money envelope, and I hand it over to the girl, and she kind of looks at me like, you're Wynonna Judd. Where's your, you know, platinum-plated credit card that says the fabulous touring Wynonna Judd of love?
The money envelope is a thing with her. It has to have bills of every denomination, including a couple hundreds, all facing the same way. She was ready to whip out one of the hundreds the other day, at Starbucks of all places, but she stopped herself.
And I'm thinking, wait a minute, whoa. Time out. What am I going to do with this coffee press? I don't press coffee. And I just remember thinking, you know, this is really ridiculous.
And do you feel like it's because you're carrying around that envelope of money instead of a credit card that you're able to do that?
I think so.
So Starbucks loses a sale, Wynonna Judd can still live with herself. It's a mixed bag, this cash-only proposition. And again, there's no telling how many potential Wynonna Judds or Mary Grace Dembecks are out there trying to leave home without it, or why they might choose to. Sitting with Mary in Connecticut, I reread the letter that made her incensed. It actually said they were raising her cash advance rate.
Okay, so I've never taken a cash advance.
So you wouldn't really have to worry about this.
So I shouldn't have gotten upset with them in the first place?
Maybe.
But she's still going to switch to cash only, she says. Using the cards feels like she's getting something for nothing. And using cash hurts, but at least it feels real. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, dispatched from the front lines of macroeconomic policy and the bond market. Moody's said today it figures the U.S. government is good for its debts for the foreseeable future. That'd be about 18 months, according to Moody's. The credit rating agency reaffirmed its AAA rating on U.S. Treasury bills, the ones we've been selling by the trillions to pay for the stimulus plan, the bank bailout, and general overall cash flow. There was one note of caution, though. The company said that Washington needs to keep an eye on how much money it does owe. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 16 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost a single point, 0.7%. The S&P 500 rose 2 points, about 0.2% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this program, balancing California's budget.
I've looked at everything in the budget. There isn't an office there that isn't touched. There isn't a program that I haven't looked at, and I've gone back the second time.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.